Thank you, Jesse. My name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. And because of God's grace, sponsorship, steps, fellowship, I have been sober since June 26, 1988. Give John a finger here. Such a miracle. I spent so much time trying to stay out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not. I mean, who wants their parents' solution, right? You know, I'd been there with my dad. I knew it was full of old men that drank coffee and ate donuts and smoked. I'd seen it myself. I mean, God, my dad was 34, you know. I was 7, so. But I was at the open meetings in Hamilton, Ohio on Friday night. So Mildred said something about going to a meeting in 1966, and I was like, I went to meetings in 1966. And, you know, people look like, okay, how old are you really? And so. Thank you to Hillary for singing. I am eternally grateful that she did not sing. She got up to sing. I thought, oh, my God, if she sings Amazing Grace, I'm just going to stand up here and cry for an hour. So I'm grateful that that didn't happen. And we'll see how this goes. My plane's not till 4, so those of you, if I... I was sponsoring a woman several years ago, and we got through step 11, and she said, okay, well, step 12 is just work with a new girl, right? And I was like, oh, no, no. And, I mean, I just need to let you know, I've done an entire weekend retreat on step 12, and many times my husband and I at conventions have done a two-hour workshop on step 12, so... We'll see how this goes, but I hope you got a back. He's going for a backup CD. We're good. Okay. I had Jesse read what she read because that's one of my very favorite parts of the book. I'm a bit of an algebra. There's a lot of Type A personalities on the front row. We know who we are now. My husband, who could not read when he got sober, went on to get a master's degree in administrative social work. A lot of you have heard his story. So one day he said to me, you know, you have a type AL personality. And I thought, well, you know, he's got the degree, so I'll fine. What's that? I knew what a type A was. I'd always heard type A, and I didn't really, other than punctuation, I didn't really consider myself a type A personality. And he said, well, I have no doubt that you're a type A personality, but you are lazy enough that you're not annoying. And, So I'm guessing I'm not the only type AL in the room either. But I also, you know, math and reading, all that came easily to me as a child. Reading was my first escape. I'm quite sure that's why school was easy for me, because it took no effort. If it took work, somebody else would have had to do it. I am a bit on the lazy side, and I used to say I was a 50-yard dash girl in a 5-mile world, and I realized a few years ago, really, if you just let me put a lawn chair at the start line and bring me the trophy, I'm totally fine with that. I saw a cartoon, and it was like the instant gratification run, and they're all the start line, they're handing out the trophies. I was like, yeah, I'd run that one. I need a t-shirt that says like 0.0 instead of 26 point, whatever it is. But, you know, anybody who managed to get through 7th grade algebra, if A equals B and A equals C, then B equals C, right? And Debbie alluded to one of those things you could substitute in with the reprieve. That was a little unnerving. I'm going to have to keep that in mind. Relief from a death sentence. Yeah, that's a cheery thought. But, you know, what I had Jesse read, what it says is that... ultimately, a spiritual awakening is awareness of the presence of God. And so if I read the steps with that in mind, you know, first of all, step 3 says we've made a decision, and I went through treatment with the best of them. I'm a test taker. I could, you know, there's many of us that could have been counselors by the second week. And, you know, but they would tell us 3 frogs on a log, 1 decided to jump off, how many are left? Well, 3, fine, I could go with that, but what's that got to do with me? You know, and it wasn't until I heard Joe and Charlie speak, and Charlie spoke about, you know, every year I decided we would go on vacation, but... you know, nothing ever happened. And then 1 year we decided to go on vacation, but we arranged for time off work, and then we packed, and then we loaded the car, and then we drove. He lived in Arkansas, and they drove to Missouri, and then they drove to whatever's west of Missouri, and then they drove to whatever's west of that, and then they got to Riverside, and then they got to San Diego. And he said, so my decision that year was the same as every other year. I did not arrive in San Diego on vacation as a result of my decision. I arrived as a result of the series of actions I took after that decision. Okay? So those of you, I can sit in step three meetings sometimes and just get dizzy, you know, took it back, turned it over. It's like, you know, like a ping pong match. And what the steps tell me is, my step three is doing step four and step five and step six and step seven and step eight. And then somewhere along the line in step 11 it says improve my conscious context, which assumes I have one by now. And in step 12 it says as the result of all of these steps, I am now aware of the presence of God. And that's completely different from, if I could have found God in step three, I would only needed three steps. You know, I'm not going to work the other nine just for fun if I already got the prize. But, you know, Bill alluded to some of that. He talked about his being in Winchester Cathedral. You know, that when he finally had that spiritual experience, that day in the Winchester Cathedral came back. And he said there had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. And for those of you who are going, why, what's this got to do with step 12? Because this is all having had that spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So, you know, my powerlessness over alcohol, anybody who's heard me, there's not much debate about that. My dad even said that I never really even drank anonymously. So, but I will tell you one story that was within 6 months of getting sober. It was December of 1987. My children had been in my mother's custody already for almost 3 years. That had not sobered me up. And it was a couple weeks before Christmas. My son was in kindergarten. He had a little kindergarten, you know, a little school Christmas program that night. And I am now living in my friend's attic. I used to say I moved into an attic apartment, and I realized that 17 years sober, it was not an apartment until I put a bed up there. It was an attic. And so I'm living in Kathy's attic, and it's within walking distance to the lovely Dewdrop Inn in Norwood, Ohio. And so I walked up there about noon to get a drink. And from my mom was supposed to pick me up at 6 for this kindergarten program. And from about 2, you know, because once again, once I take a drink, that physical allergy that says I have to have another has begun. I had no intention of sitting there all day, but for the last, probably from 2 o'clock to 5:45, I just sat there and agonized. Do I just not be there when they come pick me up? Or am I drunk when they come pick me up? Which is worse? Which is worse? Not being there, being drunk. You know, I didn't want to do that to my 6-year-old son, but I was in the grips of a power that had me. And finally, at 5:45, I grabbed my stuff and I ran to the house. And my mom told me after I got sober that when they pulled in the driveway and I walked out the door, my 6-year-old son said, "Oh, no." He's 34 now. But I understand that powerlessness, you know. And as a kid, I mean, I grew up believing in God. I went to a non-threatening church. I was in youth group up until I drank. And we had an unfortunate overnight incident in which many of us drank. And that was the end of youth group overnights for a while. And I didn't realize for a long time that that's when I walked away from church, because we had this, you know, kind of incident Saturday night. And then so we all went to church Sunday knowing we better be there. And I was so sick and so hungover. And I tried my best, and I had to leave halfway through because I was so, so sick. And I was 16 years old, and I never went back. And I didn't, you know, a lot of stuff we get in hindsight, I didn't realize how long it had been, that that's when that turned. And when I got here, I still believed in God, but I didn't, when I got here, I wasn't praying because I didn't want him to know where I was, okay? I wanted to just stay under his radar. You know, it's like that little GPS doesn't activate if you don't say, "Dear God," you know, my tin hat, he can't find me, you know. So I always believed in God, but what I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is how to rely on God, and there's a difference. There is a difference. I can believe in God, but do I trust him? I didn't trust him to do anything for me. What had I done for him, you know? So, but I remember, you know, as I stayed sober, I realized that when I was 15 years old, I read this kind of Christian fiction book called Pontius Pilate, and where they, you know, they insert dialogue and stuff. And as I'm reading it, I remember being overwhelmed with the presence and power of God. Now, it's not like I didn't know how the story turned out. You know what I mean? But still, as I read the book, I was overwhelmed with God's presence. And I wanted that again. So I went back to the bookstore and tried to find another book exactly like that one. Because what I always tried to do was go back and recreate it. I did not understand that God is a forward journey. And it exponentially gets bigger and bigger. So I wanted a do-over. You know, and I went and I found another book that kind of looked the same. And I started, and by page 20, I'm like, this isn't it. And, you know, and I probably went and got a beer. You know, I just did. I didn't drink till I was 15. I would not have told you I was holding my breath until I took a drink. But when I took a drink, I exhaled. And I didn't know I'd been holding my breath all that time. I've got an active committee, as I said. I did some drive-by AA I talked about a little last night, and they would talk about being self-centered, and I would think, well, that doesn't apply to me. You know, I thought self-centered meant vain and selfish. And I'm neither, just ask. And, you know, I didn't know self-centered meant I thought everybody was talking about me. I didn't know self-centered meant if I can't win, I don't want to play. Not because I'd lose, but because you would see me lose. I didn't know self-centered meant I will never try anything new in public because you might see me do it wrong. You know, I didn't know self-centered meant if I walked in and two people back there leaned their head together and laughed, I knew they were talking about something I did 5 years ago. You know, I didn't know any of that. I lived my life with this little camera that watched all of you watch me, you know, and for the, we won't be going through the steps in any kind of order either. So the ADD kind of keeps the type A at bay too. But I was talking to Amber from Texas last night and about something I'd said a few years ago that, you know, like I said, I was a biker when I got sober. And the only reason I had fear on my first inventory is because the one in the book had fear, 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 fear. And I thought, all right, well, if it's on every one, I should probably write it down or my sponsor will think I didn't do it right. So I wrote fear, but I didn't have a clue. And what the book says is we found after we did our inventory that the world and its people dominated us. And I didn't get that. I didn't have physically abusive parents. I didn't have physically abusive relationships. Who knows why, where I kept company, but I just didn't. I never was a fighter, not out of any high moral ground, but I was really afraid of getting pummeled in public and looking bad. So I didn't fight. And plus, you know, it's like when fights break out, drinks get spilled. You know, I'm just a... I didn't even like hanging out with people that fought because I did learn to just do this when somebody went flying by, you know, maybe like back to, by the way, you know why you drink out of square bottles, right? I bet Nancy knows. They don't roll out from under the car seat. I did not drink Wild Irish Rose for its bouquet. What I found if I stayed here is what dominated me was what you thought of me. And I didn't have a clue that I cared what you thought of me. As a matter of fact, I spent a great deal of time saying, I don't care what you think of me. I don't care what you think of me. And the whole time I said, I don't care what you think of me, I cared desperately what you thought of me. But I didn't even know, like that person that took my hand or that remembered my name when I was new, I didn't even know I wanted you to remember my name. So how could I ever ask? You know, we get caught up sometimes with new people like, well, they really need to call us. Well, yeah, they really do. On the other hand, if somebody hadn't grabbed me on day 3 when the clubhouse in Cincinnati closed at 10 o'clock instead of 1 in the morning because they had midnight meetings, I don't know. I was a bar drinker. I was a last call bar drinker. That's where I dated was last call, you know. Oh, like you did it, right? Yeah. So I got to the 7:30 Sunday night meeting, my third day out of detox, and I'm already panicking. What am I going to do when this meeting's over? It's only going to be 10 o'clock. And before the meeting even started, a lady that had been, I'd been going to noon meetings too, because I had a lot of time on my hands, and she grabbed my hand and said, after the meeting, don't go anywhere, we're going to the movies. Now, if she had said, do you want to go to the movies? I, of course, would have said, oh, no. And then prayed she asked again, because I really did want to go, but you can't be too willing, because that would look bad. You know, you can't be too anxious. So you need to ask me twice, and the second time I'll say, well, if you really want me to, you know. She didn't ask if I had any money. She didn't ask, did I want to see this movie? She just said, we're going to the movies. And it was 1988, June. It was actually where I got out of detox on July 1st. So this was like the 3rd of July. My life was on hold till July 5th. My car was impounded. I knew if I'd gone where I lived, I would drink. So I had a cheap hotel that was on the bus line, or I could walk out the door, get on the bus, and ride it to the AA clubhouse, because I knew I would drink if I went where I lived. And it just so happened there was a 10 o'clock show that night of Roger Rabbit, which if any of you have seen it, it's about 8.5 hours long. So it got me through till the bar closed, you know, and I'm so grateful for that. And I try to remember that. And people were so kind to my children. I brought my children to meetings when I was new because I knew, because I would have them on weekends, you know. But I knew if I just stayed with them, I'd just yell at them all weekend, you know. My biggest fear when I got sober was, will I even be able to love my children? Or has alcoholism wiped away that ability in me? Because it does. It just empties us out. We are emotional black holes. We not only don't have any, we will suck them out of you if you're anywhere near us. And I didn't know if I'd be able to love my children. And so I brought them to meetings with me. And you guys, by watching you, I learned how to talk to them because you called them by name. You sat down and talked to them eye to eye. They had become invisible around me because if you're between me and a drink, you were invisible or you're plowed over. And they had become invisible. And I love the promises after the fifth step to say we can look the world in the eye because they began to look the world in the eye because of all of you. And you remembered their names and you knew that Robbie played soccer. And the noon meeting, they would go upstairs and get a pot of coffee and bring it down. And somebody always had Sarah help go carry the cups, you know. And they became part of, and I learned how to interact with them because of you. So, you know, God help me if you ever see me glare at a woman whose child is making noise in a meeting. There are a lot of us. I'm not going to die if I miss a meeting. She might. If she will give me her child, I will take that child somewhere and play with them till that meeting's over. You know, that's what people did for me. So worldly clamors, what were they? What's he doing? Where is he? Who is he? Please send him. You know, what are they doing? What are they saying? I know they're talking about me. And my whole committee majored in worldly clamors. It's the noise that drowns out the music of God. You know, that still small voice that's always there. You know, review of pre-sobriety relationships showed that every disaster I ever had was preceded by a moment, usually within the first 3 weeks, that said, no, 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 this is not the one. And in my best Scarlett O'Hara, I would say, I'll worry about that tomorrow. Because if I said, you're not the one, he might have said, why are you living at my house? You know, so. Got to be a little pragmatic when you're out there, you know. So I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself. And, you know, Sandy Beach was one of my heroes all the way through. So those of you who go, she stole this from Sandy Beach. Yes, I did. But he left us, and it's a message worth carrying. You know, when I drank, I turned my will and my life over to one power, alcohol. It did everything for me. It decided who I talked to. It found my friends. It dictated my jobs. If I was confused or afraid, 2 or 3 drinks later, I intuitively know how to handle this situation. You know what I mean? It's like, it's his, my favorite example of his. You get a certified letter. Those are never good news. You know, you go to the bar by the 3rd drink. You know what to do. Tear up the letter. You know. So without even realizing it, I had already been turning my will and life over to a power greater than me. And one of the things they said to me was, Beth, we've conclusively, you know, we're pretty convinced that alcohol is a power greater than you. You better hope there's another power greater than alcohol. But that concept of, you know, because you get a sponsor and you say, God, I don't have any money until say, well, you know, pray and go talk to that new girl. And I one day I was like, I have 10 days. I, you know, I am the new girl here. And and my sponsor said, she's got 2 days. You've been sober 5 times longer than her. Go tell her how you did it. And you know what? After I talked to her, I felt better. You know, it works. But I didn't know, you know, I guess what I'm saying to you is when you get here and we tell you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, this one power who has it all, and you think, oh no, but I have money problems and I have one power. You know, I didn't realize that I had spent since age 15, turning my life over to one power already. And when I looked at that, it became less impossible to turn my life over to one power now. And somebody talked about Carl Jung's letter, you know, that he wrote. And it's reprinted in the back of AA Comes of Age. But he talks about that we were seeking that spirit, and that we were just with the little S spirit instead of the capital S spirit. You know, so I just thank God there's a power greater than me. And I'm, you know, I believe God's help comes through interruption. Debbie was talking about roadblocks today. I believe a lot of times, you know, I want God to just drop a neon sign in front of me, which occasionally he does if I've been ignoring hints, you know. Then when a load of bricks hits and we're like, couldn't you have sent me a hint? And he's just like, oh, my God. But, you know, I found a lot of times that God's help comes through interruption. And I sponsored a girl who drank after 4 months, and she'd been in and out for 20 years. And she was really mad at God because she was in Kroger, and she just, you know, had the urge to drink. And said, please, God, I don't want to drink. And then she went and got a bottle of vodka, which in Cincinnati is disgusting because Ohio has state stores. So it's like way watered down if it's in the grocery. And just a little aside there, if you ever, you know, if you're ever in Ohio and, you know, don't want to be with us anymore, go to the state store. But I said, and so I asked her, I said, well, you know, when you got that, did you go to the express lane? Well, of course she did. You know, and I said, well, how many people in front of you wrote checks? And she sat there a minute, and you could just see the color drain from her face. And it had taken 20 minutes for the two people ahead of her in line to get through the line. She had 20 minutes that she could have just left the card and walked away. You know, God's help doesn't always look like I expect it to look, but it's always there. Always there. And so those speed bumps that we get are to get our attention, I believe. I told you my inventory is dominated by others. And when I came in, I used to wonder why people didn't want to shake my hand. But I'm sure I look like I would break your arm if you did, you know. And I love it because so many of us, we come in like this. We're just like, help me, you know. I don't need you. I don't like you. Why aren't you talking to me? So, and I fell into a crowd that was very involved in the Big Book, and someone had said to me, now when I got out of detox, they had a 30-day program, which I was prepared to go through, and they said something to me. I was very insulted at the time, but I'm sure they saved my life. They said, Beth, you know, you already know what we're going to tell you. Why don't you go do it and save the bed space for somebody that doesn't have the information? Yeah. If I'd had 30 days to rest up, I would have had a plan B by the time I got out. Got to have a plan B. And when I was in detox that day, I didn't have a plan B. I did not have one better idea about what to do about any of it. And I realized I wasn't going to die, you know, and I did not want to live, you know, as bad as things were on and off. I knew there was way worse out there that I hadn't had to do yet. And I knew it was out there waiting on me if I did. And so I started going to this Big Book meeting for many reasons, which I don't have time to go into today. But after a couple of weeks, a lady there, the one that took me to the movie, said, you know, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I thought, okay. I mean, I didn't know I could go, oh, gosh, I'm not ready, you know. I sat down with the Big Book. I read the directions, you know. I mean, the fourth column even, you know, I found that in the directions. The woman that I asked to hear my fifth step was a woman who, the night I got out of detox, I went to a meeting, and she told my biggest secret from the podium. She told a room full of people that alcoholism, not drinking, alcoholism had taken her to a place in life where she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I thought, I can't believe she said that out loud. Because my biggest secret, my kids have been with my mother 2.5 years, but my deep, dark, you know, the book talks about having a double life, the one we want the world to see and the one we know is true. I didn't really want my kids back. I knew they were better off with her. You know, they got breakfast at her house. They got to daycare and clean clothes. They were, my mother at 51 years old, let me give a shout out to the Al-Anons who love us in spite. At 51 years old, with a 2 a.m. phone call, my mother became the single parent of a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old with absolutely no warning in 1985. I got sober in 1988, okay? She fed them. She clothed them. They were in clean clothes. They slept in clean sheets. They got to daycare on time. She remembered to pick them up from daycare. They ate age-appropriate dinner. They got a story read to them every night. They got a bath every night. I could not have done any of that. And I was not particularly gracious to her for doing it, you know, because I don't like to look bad. I just was not nice to her. I really laid every problem I ever had from age far back as I can remember at her feet. I was born in Northern California. I was supposed to be a California girl. Thank God I would have been hitchhiking to Oregon with you. I'm sure of it, you know. And you would have been like, no, not that kid. But I apparently due to my dad's drinking, they moved to Ohio, which was my first resentment. I was 2 1/2, moved against my will. And by age 6, I'm looking at a map of the United States on the first day of first grade, seeing California and Texas and Florida and oceans and the Gulf and in Ohio, thinking you can tell looking at a map that nothing's happening in Ohio, you know. In hindsight, I grew up in Oxford, Ohio, where Miami University is. It was a wonderful small town. I grew up in that small town where it was safe to walk. We walked to school. I was attending college sporting events, you know, at 6 years old. I loved college sports. It was a wonderful place to grow up. But what I know now is already by age 6, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. Already by age 6, I am looking for something out there to make this better in here. If I get this, I would be, if I had a brother or a sister, if I wasn't an only child, and God knows then I would have had to share, so I wouldn't like that either, you know. But if I had better carpet in my room, if my mom didn't sit, you know, she sat more like a lady, if I had this, then I would be all right. And I would, but when you're 6, you can't articulate that. If somebody had said, what is wrong with you? I would have said, I hate Ohio. I couldn't have told you I'm suffering from a spiritual malady that only a spiritual experience will conquer, you know? So anyway, I wrote this and I shared my fifth step at 3 1/2, 4 weeks sober, never looked back. My life took off. My life took off. And of course, 6 and 7, you know, the first time through, there are only a couple paragraphs in the big book, and I was hanging out with big book people, and it went until I was about 3 years sober that 6, it comes back. You know, it just really just hit me in the side of the head, like that first wave of what step 6 really means. A friend of mine in the big book meeting was saying, yeah, you know, I know I'm lustful, but if I give that to God and He takes it, what if I never get laid again? You know? And I know I lie, but I lie to get what I want. And so if I stop lying, what if I don't? By the way, if you're new, the words of wisdom from old timers, this was just like so cosmic. Okay, if you don't want to feel like a liar, stop lying. I feel like such a thief. Stop stealing things, you know. Where do they get this stuff? I just was amazed, you know. As Bob Bazans would say, I just wanted to do it without consequence. I didn't really want to stop, you know. So, you know, I just had this vision while Gary was talking of this, you know, the carpenter belt and that my character defects are my tools in that tool belt, okay? They're my tools. They're what I use to get what I want. Even for being an accountant, I'm a bit of a visual thinker, which Peggy says is the only reason I'm not a complete asshole. So, you know, I apparently have enough right brain to balance out the type A side. But, you know, I just had this vision of this tool belt, and all these character defects are my tools to get what I want. And you want me to take off this tool belt and lay it on the ground, bad enough, but then hold hands with God and AA. Now, if I do that and my tool belt's down there, what am I going to let go of to pick up my tools? God or AA? Okay, there they are. So now I got all my stuff that I've gotten in sobriety. I love my stuff, don't get me wrong. But it's all out here, okay? Fear of losing things. Right. What do I let go of to hang on to my stuff? God or AA? I better just trust the stuff is there when it's supposed to be and it leaves when it's supposed to. If I have my hands with God and AA, I do not have a hand to grab my stuff, use my defects, run my life as it. I ran it so successfully before I got here. So I had been kind of struggling with cramming this all into an hour, so I'd had this kind of step 6 and 7 story that I thought, well, I'll leave that out. So many people have heard it. And then I walked by Friday night and somebody said, Jersey Mike's. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, that changed my life. So I went, okay. So here's my Jersey Mike's story. I worked for my mother and then with my mother. When I got sober, I was unemployable. So I answered phones at her office. She was a CPA, and then I gradually went back to school and became a CPA as well. And so I worked for her. And yet, to understand this, I lived in Cincinnati, and we lived in Madera, Ohio. And then her office was in Montgomery, and Jersey Mike's is in Blue Ash. Now, here's Madera, here's our office, here's Jersey Mike's, all right? So I would be going to lunch, I'm going home for lunch, this way, okay? And she'd say, on your way back, could you get me a Jersey Mike's? Clearly, Jersey Mike's is not on the way back, okay? Home, office, home, office. Jersey Mike's, home, office, home, office. Now, to be fair, you have to understand this is probably a 3.5-mile loop total, you know? Not the point. The point is, it is not on the way. So I would get her sandwich, but you know how we are with the body language, and you know, I give her a sandwich, and I just... So I had mentioned it to Ashley after she spoke that where I started with my mother was, what would you say if you liked her? That's where I had to start. What would I say to your mother? I would never talk to your mother the way I talk to mine. What would I say if she was your mother? What would I say if I liked her? So I just, for some reason, had this thought of, you know, maybe, like, or what would a good daughter do? There's a concept. And I find that even today, days I'm evaluating her parenting skills, we are screwed. Days that I'm in my own hula hoop just doing what a good daughter would do, we are fine. There's a difference. So I thought, well, what would a good daughter do? Okay, probably would say something like, I'd be glad to. So I laid the trap, you know. I'm going home for lunch. On your way back, could you pick me up at Jersey Mike's? I'd be glad to. Through gritted teeth, you know. It's like, I'd be like your sponsor tells you, I'd be delighted. I brought her back a sandwich. For the next 2 weeks, this went on. I would say, I'd be delighted. I'd be glad to. I'd be happy to. And a couple of weeks later, I realized that I didn't mind doing it anymore. And a couple of weeks after that, I heard myself say to her, hey, Mom, I'm going out for lunch. Can I bring you back a sandwich? Now, I love it when people talk about, well, I've been praying to have this defect removed, but I guess God just hasn't taken it yet. Because the 12 and 12 says he's not going to without our cooperation, you know. And to me, step 6 and step 1 are so parallel, because when we ask God to remove the obsession, we don't just sit home and pray for him to remove the obsession. We substitute an entire new set of behaviors for the old ones. We go to meetings. We get a sponsor. We call the sponsor. We read the book. We work the steps. And we pray that the obsession is removed. Okay? So with step 6, I didn't just ask him to remove the defect. I substitute a new set of behaviors. I said I'd be delighted. As I took the new appropriate action, it became easier, it became habit, and then it began to be enjoyable, just like AA. It's the same deal. It's the same deal. 6 and 7, of course I'm going to ask God. But I take the action. And I take the same action to stay sober now that I did when I was new. But my heart has been changed by God. God changes hearts here. But I have to be out of his way, and I have to be cooperating. So, you know, my dad was sober most of my childhood, and the last thing he ever said to me, he used to talk about having, you know, 9 lives and realizing he'd used up 8 of them, and maybe he should get sober and see what God wanted. And I had, you know, this incident that had caused my mom to get my kids. This is back when, you know, we just all had landlines and no caller ID. So if you were my friend, you knew to call twice, ring twice, hang up, call back. I also, by the way, have not needed an unlisted phone number since June 26, 1988. So, but I, you know, so anybody up as it just rang and rang, I knew. And apparently my phone had been shut off and I didn't even know because I was talking to no one, you know. And my dad drove down to Cincinnati from Oxford to be sure that I was alive and the kids were okay. And when he left, he turned. I had a second floor house, you know, a house had been converted to apartments, and I lived on the second. He came in and up the stairs. And I'll never forget, he turned around the bottom of the stairs and looked up the stairs at me and said, don't you think you've about used up your 9 lives? Now, I didn't know that was the last thing. I said nothing. I didn't know that was the last thing he was ever going to say to me. I was in a treatment center, all female, go figure, 6 weeks. God's got a sense of humor. That was the one my no insurance plan could afford. And so I'm in treatment, and in this place you had no outside contact for the first 2 weeks, but I got a phone call on day 10 because my father had died the night before suddenly. He had an abdominal aortic aneurysm. He fell asleep watching TV, never woke up. And so that kind of wrecked my plan to go be sober with him. I was going to go be Jim's daughter in AA because I never knew how to be Beth. I don't know how. If I tell you my name's Beth, I feel like you're waiting for the rest. I always had to be, you know, Beth the cheerleader, Beth the night auditor, Beth. I was busy, 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 busy because I never knew, but I had to do all this stuff just to take up my space. I didn't feel like I justified my space. And, you know, arrogance covers up a lot of fear. I didn't know that. So my dad died while I was in treatment, and then I didn't stay sober out of that treatment. I didn't get sober for 3 more years. And when I was a couple months sober, I went up to his old home group in Oxford, and where I had I'd grown up there. I didn't leave there till I was 19. And I got there after it started. A couple people knew who I was, but I ended up, a guy at the very end, he said, you know, Jim Kirby always used to say, and the hair on my arm stood up, because I'd been watching this guy, and he sat like my dad, he drank coffee like my dad, he looked a little like my dad, and then he goes, Jim Kirby used to say this, and I was just like, and it turned, so I went over and after, and I said, I'm Jim Kirby's daughter, and he just burst into tears. My dad had been his sponsor, and but what I realized after that was, what do any of us with children, what do we want to tell people? If anybody asks, how are your kids? We just want to tell them that they're okay, they're happy, you know. I mean, that's all any of us want. And where I grew up, our family doctor was, you know, I mean, he was my grandmother's doctor, my parents' doctor, my doctor. And so my amends to my father was to once or twice a year while I lived in Cincinnati, go to a meeting in Oxford so that his friends knew I was okay. Because he would want them to know I was okay. And once I moved to North Carolina, I sent Christmas cards to his old sponsor every year until he died. Because that's what he would have wanted, you know. He would have wanted to have been able to say, you know, Beth's good. She's sober. She's remarried. The kids are great. There's a granddaughter. You know, that was my amend to my dad. 10 through 12 has been masterfully covered, so I'm not going to go a lot into that. Other than to say I agree with everything. I do love the part in the book where it talks about we pause when agitated or doubtful. That was my favorite spot in the book too. And that it says, you know, we relax and take it easy. We ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while, okay? What used to be the hunch or occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Now, you'll notice there's a lot of useful, you know, gradually, after we've tried it, it does not say we're going to be instantly inspired. And it even says, just in case we don't figure that out for ourselves, being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. As proof to this, I present to you the treatment center romance. He's here, I'm here, God's will. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. So there's that rely word again, you know. I have become aware of the presence of God as the result of these steps. And even early on, I noticed little changes. Like, I remember I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 weeks sober, and an ambulance went by. And my first thought was, that's someone's daughter. That's someone's father. And I said a prayer. And I remember thinking, where did that come from? You know, I don't even know who's in it, but it's somebody's son or daughter or mother or father or brother. And that was the first sign to me that something was changing. So we try to carry this message to alcoholics. Doesn't say my message, the message, any message, pick a message. It says this message. You know, what is this message? This message, A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relayed our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. This is the message that I am to carry. And I brought some non-conference approved writing, but it's the parallels are astounding. This is something I like to read because it's called the life-saving station, and anybody who knows me has heard it already. But on a dangerous seacoast where shipwrecks often occur, there was once a crude little life-saving station. The building was just a hut, and there was only one boat. But the few devoted members kept a constant watch over the sea, and with no thought for themselves, went out day and night tirelessly searching for the lost. Many lives were saved by this wonderful little station so that it became famous. Some of those who were saved and various others in the surrounding area wanted to become associated with the station and give of their time and money and effort for the support of its work. New boats were bought and new crews trained. The little life-saving station grew. Some of the members of the life-saving station were unhappy that the building was so crude and poorly equipped. They felt that a more comfortable place should be provided as the first refuge of those saved from the sea. Just for them, mind you. Only for them, you know. So they replaced the emergency cots with beds and got better furniture in the enlarged building. Now the life-saving station became a popular gathering place for its members, and they decorated it beautifully and furnished it exquisitely because they used it as sort of a club. Fewer members were now interested in going to sea on life-saving missions, so they hired lifeboat crews to do this for them. The life-saving motif still prevailed in the club's decoration, and there was a liturgical lifeboat in the room where the club initiations were held. About this time, a large ship was wrecked off the coast, and the hired crews brought in some boatloads of wet, cold, half-drowned people. They were dirty and sick, and some of them had black skin and some had yellow skin. The beautiful new club was in chaos. So the property committee immediately had a shower built outside the club where victims of the shipwreck could be cleaned up before coming inside. Treatment centers. At the next meeting, there was a split in the club membership. Most of the members wanted to stop the club's life-saving activities as being unpleasant and a hindrance of the normal social life of the club. Some members insisted on life-saving as their primary purpose and pointed out they were still called a life-saving club or life-saving station. But they were finally voted down and told if they wanted to save lives of all the various kinds of people who were shipwrecked in those waters, they could begin their own life-saving station down the coast. So they did. As the years went by, the new station experienced the same changes that had occurred in the old one. It evolved into a club, and yet another life-saving station was founded. History continued to repeat itself, and if you visit that seacoast today, you will find a number of exclusive clubs along that shore. Shipwrecks are frequent in those waters, but most of the people drown. This is why we carry this message. This is why in meetings we have conference-approved literature. It's not that there's not good non-conference literature out there, but to me, and I'll give step out here my opinion, it's Pandora's box. Because if I want to read New Pair of Glasses, which is awesome, but it's not GSO literature, then why can't we read Women Who Love Too Much? Okay? Or whatever. There's a reason that we have to stay on message here. This is the message that saved my life. This is the message that saved my father's life. This is the message that saved, you know, generations before us and, God willing, generations after us. And I can't get caught up in, oh, let somebody else do it, you know. Harry Thiebaud wrote a paper called Ego Factors and Alcoholism. And there were two things of interest to me in there. One is, he said, never, never underestimate the power of the ego to regenerate itself. I don't know about you, but I came in surrendered every time I came in. But let's face it, it's easy to surrender when you're out of bullets. At about day three, usually the first thing I would get back would be my opinion. And then I would start to judge all of you and judge my way. You know, it's very hard to feel like one of many when you're in a room and you've had an opinion on everybody in it. He also said that surrender is not an event, it's a discipline. And if I take that thought into the big book, somewhere on a page I didn't mark, but I know it's in here, it says, we alcoholics are undisciplined people.
You think?
So we let God discipline us with the steps outlined in this book. Okay? So staying in the steps is how I stay surrendered. That surrender in 1988 is not going to do anything for me today any more than the gas I put in my car in February is going to drive me home from the airport. I have to stay current. I have to keep my spiritual tires full. You know, that's why I love these conventions. It's like a battery recharge because we, you know, there are unfortunately around every town some meetings that are an hour of the problem rather an hour of the solution. And you can get dragged down into it. And I, you know, I have been to meetings where I think I'm never coming back here, never, never. And then I think, you know, then the sober committee member says, you have to, because someone has to be here who reads the book. Somebody has to be here to invite these people to other meetings, you know. So surrender is a discipline. I have to stay surrendered to stay here. I have to stay teachable. I no longer, you know, my biggest fear was, God, don't let me be average, you know. I'll be the worst or the best. I don't care. Just please notice me, you know. My strength is being in the middle. My strength is in being one of many. My strength is in being, that whole time I was trying to be Beth the cheerleader, Beth the night auditor, Jim's daughter, whatever. You know, I was really seeking Beth Hartley, child of God. I didn't know that's what I was looking for. You know, but this is AA. It's just it's a big family reunion of the children of God, you know, and it's like Chuck Chamberlain used to say, we are all God's kids. We need to act like it, you know, play nice with the other kids. That's what the end of my email tagline says. Remember to play nice with the other kids today. And just for the record, my Yay God license plate is because I have grown into a relationship with God over the years that began with getting to know you, fairly know, you know, uncomfortable silences, getting to know him better. You know, then I went through my God is awesome stage and then, you know, my Yay God stage. But also, just in the spirit of total honesty, that license plate causes me to drive way better than I want to drive on a lot of days. Because I cannot tailgate someone, lean on my horn, whip around, cut in front of them just to teach them a lesson with Yay God on my license plate. So I keep Yay God in a teeny, teeny, tiny circle and triangle on my car. Because I just, I remember thinking, I was driving up, I was pretty new, and I was driving up the highway in Cincinnati and just thinking, I do my best thinking in the car, which is why I've been in Tape of the Month Club since I got sober. Thank God for the tapers. When I turned my car on, AA was speaking, and they can drown out the voices in my head. But I'm like driving up the road thinking, and a car goes by, and it says, easy does it. And it was like, oh, yeah. You know, just all these little things I started to notice that reminded me I did not have to do it by myself. So I, you know, surrender, I always thought of surrender as losing. But surrender is placing my outcome in the hands of another. You know, when an army surrenders to another army, I mean, they hope they're going to get fed and not shot. But, you know, they are placing their outcome in the hands of the other side. So when I surrender, I'm not a loser. I'm not giving up. I'm placing my outcome in God's hands when I surrender to God. So, practice these principles. Sandy always used to talk about writing God into your story, that every day is a new page in our book, and that he liked to say, I can't wait to see what you write today, God. And that how my day goes is totally up to me. My ego is a filter through which my circumstances are interpreted. It's the narrator. It's the editor in hindsight. What happens, it's going to rain no matter what I think about it. I can be thrilled because we need the rain, or I can be pissed off because my picnic just got canceled. Either way, it's rain, and how I feel about it is up to me. What happens, happens. What I decide about it, I was actually doing a workshop on this, on writing God into your story, in Virginia, and we were in a hotel, and you know, because we'd gone up the night before, and it's one at Hampton Inn or something, has breakfast, right? So we get down there, and I'm not even a big breakfast eater, but it's the principle of the thing, okay? And so, like, their whatever they cooked their eggs in was broken, so there's no eggs. There's a line of 22 children from the waffle iron, you know, like, waffles aren't going to be happening today. And I'm getting just a little pissy about this, you know? I mean, they're supposed to have hot breakfast. Now, when I was living in that attic, I would have been happy to see a donut, you know? And I realized, it's like, I could have a great day because, you know, truly, I like Raisin Bran. I had a bowl of Raisin Bran. So I could be happy that there's Raisin Bran, or I can be just pissed off that I didn't get my waffle. The same breakfast is going to occur either way, you know? So I try... When I got sober as Dr. Alcoholic Addict, they renamed it and moved it. Since Jesse has blabbed to everyone about page 512, I will admit to you that I was kind of hoping they'd put me on page 447. Those of you who got sober before 2001 will know what that means. Acceptance is the answer to all my... Why do they want me to read page 447? Because they moved his story. But anyway, so if you flip a couple pages from that, it says, I have found my expectations are inversely proportional. My serenity is inversely proportional to my expectations. Okay? The higher my expectations, the lower my serenity. And about the time I get my expectations under control, my rights move in and serenity goes out the window again. So I have to ask myself, how important is it really? And I love that because there's a pastor that I love who actually his church is here in Atlanta. And when Chuck and I first moved to North Carolina, he worked on Sundays and I didn't want to go build a whole church, you know, family while he was working Sundays. And this church down here had almost like a tape of the month. You could subscribe to their sermons. So once a month I get 4 CDs with his talk. And I love this guy. He could have been, if he'd have, you know, pushed through that getting sick while he drank thing, he would have been here with us. I'm convinced. Some people are just unwilling to push through the uncomfortable parts, you know. But he said that, you know, like when people were getting ready, where's Jane? When people get ready to get married, okay, and they have these dreams and desires, and he's real big on visual aids too, which is why I like him. And so he had a little house, a playhouse with a picket fence, and there's a piggy bank. You wanted to save for retirement together, and you want to have kids, and you put a little doll in there, and the nice car, and all this stuff is going in the roof of this house, right? And he goes, then you get married, and he reaches down, and he picks up a plain brown cardboard box and he sets it down and he picks up the house and he just turns it upside down and dumps it into the box, turns the box around and says, expectations. And he said, when have you ever felt joy at an expectation met? Versus a desire. So I try to keep desires in my life and not expectations. I try to keep excitement in my life, not expectations. There is no joy in an expectation being met, you know. My husband, God love him, he's been doing laundry since before we got married, you know. And I will let you know that every single week I say thank you for doing the laundry. Not like, well, it's your job. Of course you did the laundry. Every week, thank you. Thank you for doing the laundry. Thank you. Thank you for making coffee. I inadvertently stumbled on. Somebody said, well, how do you guys get along so well? And I thought, what do we do? I saw three things clearly. We say something nice. We do something nice that they're perfectly capable of doing for themselves. And we thank them for doing something for us. Every day. Now, it's harder than it's. I gave this to a friend of, you know, one of my sponsees who was married, and she called me 2 weeks later. I've been doing this for 2 weeks, and he hasn't thanked me for anything yet. You know, not the point. We get by giving. We feel better by giving. Chuck's got a bad back. You know, one of the unfortunate relationships prior to him had a bad back, and this guy put the mayonnaise on the top shelf of the refrigerator and a couple other things. Now, everybody knows the mayonnaise goes in the second shelf on the door. I'm sorry, but that's where it goes. He put it where he could reach it without hurting his back. So when Chuck and I, you know, had a home together and I was moving in the refrigerator, I put the mayonnaise and the Diet Pepsi and things that clearly don't go together on the top shelf, and he was stunned. And I was like, that's what we do. And I used to leave for work first, so I would get the newspaper and bring it in and take the sports page out and put it on top. Now, he's perfectly capable of opening the paper up. But when he got up, because he was working second shift for a while, and saw that sports page, it was like it said, I thought of you this morning. You know? How hard is it to say something nice? And it's not just for a spouse, for a friend. How hard is it to say something nice, do something nice, thank them for doing something for us? Isn't that practicing these principles in all our affairs? Isn't that trying to carry this out into the world? If I'm a spiritual giant in here and then I'm an asshole in the airport and you guys see me doing that, you know, or if you're my Kroger cashier and you have let three people ahead of me with 15 items in the 12-item line, and I get up there and throw my money on the counter and glare at you and take my, you know, because 12 items. I do count things. And then 3 weeks later, you walk into a meeting and I'm greeting at the door. Do you want what I have? We are the only big book people see. I'm the only big book my employer sees. I'm the only big book, one of the few that our pastors at our church see, you know. I am, and I didn't go back to church till I was 8 years sober, by the way. And if you want to talk about that after, I'll be glad to talk to you about it after. What I will say from in here, because people get in an uproar if someone says church sometimes, outside issue, outside issue, outside issue, I will let you know that in my opinion, so is bashing church. Bashing church is also an outside issue. Peggy Martin is my sponsor. Football will never be an outside issue. Go Panthers. So I practice these principles in all my affairs. Because I have been here, because I have been with you, because I was told to watch and learn, and for whatever reason I actually did it, I have learned to be a wife here. I have learned to be a mother here. I have learned to be an employee here. I'm a sponsor. I'm a pigeon. Yes, I'm a pigeon. For those who get offended by the word, just because I've got a couple minutes left, I'm going to tell you where it came from, because there are lots of stories out there and they're all wrong. Those who study words know that over time, meaning of words changes. For example, if you were brand new and Friday night you had just walked in and heard Hillary announce from the microphone that Amanda is leading a train, what would you have thought? Words change over time. That must be a dated reference. Anyway, so if you find a dictionary from the early 1900s and look up the word pigeon, there are two things of interest in there. One is that pigeon-eyed meant drunk. The other is that three or four definitions down, it says an object for whom one holds great affection. Dr. Bob called them his pigeons out of great affection. What's good enough for Dr. Bob is good enough for me. Now, I live in the South. They say sponsees. I've tried. I've been there for almost 14 years, and I'm up to about 50-50 with it. You know, I can say my sponsee, but sister sponsee just does not. You know, I grew up with sister pigeons, meaning we have the same sponsor. So anyway, I'm a pigeon. You can be my sponsee if you want, but I'm a pigeon. I'm a sponsor. I'm a citizen. I vote. Can't complain if you don't participate. I am a responsible pet owner. I'm a grandmother. I know you're thinking, oh, no way, you're way too young to be a grandmother. That little princess, and many of you only kind of know her as the princess from Facebook, because when she was born, I always joke that if you sponsored all the princesses I did, you would have to be the queen too. And but my daughter, you know, when my daughter had her daughter, I emailed her and I said, well, there's a new princess in town, but I'm still the queen. So her name is Jaylee. She's going to be 9 next month. She was born on the 4th of July at Fort Hood, Texas. This is probably the first year that she won't think all those parades are for her. Chuck and I were just kind of teleported to North Carolina in the end of 2002. If you want to find out if you have trust issues with God or not, let me give you this prayer. Good morning, God. Surprise me. I was in a job where I was very unhappy. I said, God, if I'm supposed to change jobs, please open the door I can't miss. I said that as I drove out of my office at 4:30. 3 hours later, my phone rang. This was a Tuesday. 3 hours later, my phone rang. A friend of mine that had, we had raised our kids together in Madera, she had moved to North Carolina 2 years before, taken a job with a little startup company. They had grown. Her CEO had walked into her office that day and said, I need somebody like you, but in accounting. And she said, oh, I know one. And she called me and said, you know, can you send your resume down? I'm thinking, right. Now I'm thinking, I just do tax returns in my mommy's office. And then I got a job in a bigger firm after my daughter. I stayed working with my mom until my daughter was a senior in high school because that allowed me to participate with the soccer games and the school trips and all of that. I got to do all that. So her senior year, she was never home anyway, and I went to a bigger firm in Cincinnati. Hated it. Please, God, open the door. I can't miss. 3 hours later, my phone rings. I send my resume thinking, yeah, right. The CEO calls me at 10 o'clock Wednesday morning, says, I'm going to have the COO call you at noon. We'd like to interview you Friday. I talked to the COO at noon. She said, a big ice storm's coming in, so you may not get an answer, but go ahead, book your ticket. We'll reimburse you. I fly down on Friday morning. All the power's still out all over. I was almost the first flight in after the ice storm. The CEO picks me up in his Volkswagen. I love startups. So, and we go to a restaurant where he has called in all the executives at, because this is for a chief financial officer position. I do tax returns. So, you know, and he just said, he sat down on the other end nursing a hangover. You know, we got there, he had two Bloody Marys and he had a beer, and I'm thinking, God, I may have to drive myself back to the airport, you know. But when the others got there, I'm in my interview clothes, they're in mittens and scarves, and, you know, and so we talked. And then he took me over to tour the building, which still didn't have any power. And then he said, well, I booked you a flight home tonight because everybody with no power was in the hotels. And he said, oh, but you're going home with an offer. And then he told me what he was going to pay me, which was 30% more than I was making. He said, because you're inexperienced, but we'll pay your housing until your house sells. So that bumps it up another, you know. And we'll fly you home on the weekend, or we'll fly Chuck here. And he said, well, the plane, we got to pay for the plane either way, you know, whichever. And, you know, stock options, yada, 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 yada. So I said, yes, because the place I worked also, just in case you're going, well, she should have given notice. This was the kind of place, if you gave notice, they escorted you to the door, okay? Or I would have given notice. That Saturday was the office Christmas party at a country club somewhere. Probably the only day of the year that no partners were there. I had already RSVP'd. No, that's not what I said, but, that, you know, I had much more around. But I just said, no, I'm unable to attend. So they already weren't expecting me. Chuck and I drove down, got all my stuff out of my office, wrote two emails. One, I resigned immediately. The other was a long one with client status where everything was, so they wouldn't have to find it, you know, did the right thing as much as I could. Monday morning, I'm on an airplane, 9:30 Monday morning, I'm at a desk in North Carolina, chief financial officer of this company. 6 days later, don't ask God if you don't mean it. I had been at my home group the Monday night before, and this wasn't even on my radar. And the next Monday, where's Beth? Oh, she moved to North Carolina. And we had told the kids that once they graduated high school, we were moving and not telling them where we went, you know, like. So as this happened, my daughter's in Columbia, South Carolina at Fort Jackson in basic training, and she called and said, what's up? And I said, I moved to North Carolina. And she's like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, no, really? So she said she would move to North Carolina when hell froze over. But as it turns out, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of my amends, you know, and that same kind of thing, if I go right now, is it okay? I heard a guy in my home group talk. He'd had a bad heart attack, and this was a couple years later, and he was jogging, and he'd just gotten married, and he had chest pain. He thought, this is it. And he said, well, God, if I got to go now, it's okay, but, you know, it's okay. He was current with a sponsor. He was current with his family. His wife knew he loved him. He was a good employee at work. And so I have kind of always, you know, it sounds morbid on the surface, but it's really not. If I periodically I will say, if I die right now, is it okay? And if it's not, I got some work to do. Chuck and I, when we got married, we went to Gatlinburg from Saturday to Thursday, and then we came to the Atlanta Roundup on our honeymoon, because why wouldn't we? We met in AA. So we're driving, it was 1992, by the way. We'll be married 24 years next month, you know. So we decided to take the back roads. It was a beautiful day. We had a Firebird with T-tops because we weren't carting around kids yet much. And you have to know, first of all, that I do not flip people off. I just don't. I just never have. I just don't. And this guy, we're in this middle of nowhere country road, and this car comes up out of nowhere and is tailgating us. So out of the top of my T-top, I go like this, which could be a princess wave. You never know. But, you know, that's all I did. Still didn't flip him off, but he knew what I meant. And I looked in the mirror in time to see him reach over the back of his seat, pull a rifle up, speeds up, pulls up alongside us, rolls his car window down this much, sticks the barrel of the gun out, pointing it at us, at which point Chuck's like, he's got a gun, and ducks, you know. Now, to be fair, I was driving. I don't know what he could have done, you know. And it all happened so fast, I didn't get mad that he didn't throw himself between me and the bullet for about an hour. But he couldn't. We would have wrecked anyway, you know. So I'm like, yes, I know. Yes, I know. So the car company fall back behind us. And I'm thinking, oh, well, at least he's not drunk. It's 9 in the morning. I'm like, oh, right, Beth, like that ever worked for you, you know. So on the third time, he pulled up alongside us. I mean, this went on. And then a car was coming, so I slammed on the brakes, and I get in front of us. I go, is there a cop anywhere when you need one? Not that day. But I remember thinking, if I die right now, if this is it okay? And I thought, yes, I just got to marry the love of my life 5 days ago. I'd rather be married longer than 5 days, God. But if I have to go right now, it's okay. You know, it's okay. Because we get to stay current here. You know, we get to love with each other, laugh with each other, cry with each other, grow up with each other. And, man, what a deal. That is not what I was looking for when I got here. I just wanted to stop getting arrested. You know, if you'd asked me what I wanted when I got here, I would have told you 3 things. I wanted my driver's license back. I wanted to stop getting arrested. And I wanted to maybe someday, maybe, remarry, preferably to a guy that had a job this time. It just never came up at last call. But we get so much more here. So I say to you, if you're new, don't give up everything that you've heard all weekend. Don't give up before the miracle happens. You know, play nice with the other kids. And have a safe trip home. Thank you.